Welcome to this special Think Tank edition of Prostate Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. We gathered a dozen urology, radiation oncology, and medical oncology clinical investigators and spent the day debating the most controversial issues in management of localized high-risk disease, PSA-only recurrence, and metastatic disease. Immediately prior to the meeting, we polled the faculty on a number of challenging cases and questions and integrated the results into the discussion. To begin, Dr. Anthony D'Amico discusses one of the most interesting data sets in recent years in the field, his work demonstrating a correlation between the duration of androgen suppression and freedom from clinical progression in patients with localized, intermediate, and high-risk tumors.
What was noted, which wasn't new, but just sort of confirmed what we already knew, is that as men advanced in age at the time of the delivery of the hormonal therapy, that it took longer for them, if ever, to return to their baseline testosterone level after 6 months of hormonal therapy. Said another way, as men aged, 6 months of hormonal therapy provided a longer interval of testosterone suppression. And the numbers of note is if you were under the age of 60, it took a year to get back to your baseline. If you're over the age of 70, it took about a year and a half to 2 years. And in men over the age of 70, 10% of men never returned to baseline, in fact, remained below the lower limit of normal for testosterone, i.e. hypogonadal, for the rest of their life with a minimum observation period of almost 5 years. The interesting thing from this observational study was that as this duration of testosterone suppression increased after 6 months of hormonal therapy, that the time to prostate cancer-specific death and all-cause death increased, suggesting that there's an association between how long your testosterone stays suppressed and how likely you are to die of prostate cancer in this particular cohort. And sort of the last observation that I think is important is when you look at the men who had the high-grade cancers, the Gleason scores of 8 to 10, where the standard of care based on RTOG 9202 subgroup analysis of the Gleason 8 to 10 tumors, at least in locally advanced disease, is to deliver a long-term hormonal therapy. You see, what emerged was something interesting, and that is if you looked at the men with the high-grade cancers who got 6 months of hormonal therapy, and you plotted the cumulative incidence of prostate cancer death stratified by whether or not their testosterone returned to their baseline level within 2 years or later than 2 years, you saw a striking difference in who died of prostate cancer and who did not. And essentially, all the prostate cancer deaths in this observational study occurred in the group in men whose testosterone rebounded quickly. And in those who did not rebound within the first 2 years, prostate cancer death was not observed. And the last provocative point I'll make is perhaps this explains why in the randomized trials with surgery of short course hormonal therapy, we've never been able to show a benefit because those are young men, median age in the low 60s, where the testosterone rebounds quickly and perhaps short-term hormonal therapy in that group is homeopathic, whereas in older men, such as in the RTOG and the European studies of radiation-managed patients, they tend to be a decade older, perhaps less virile, perhaps lower T levels, and perhaps that's why even short-course hormonal therapy in those men appears to benefit.
Thanks, Anthony. What are your thoughts about these data, Laurie?
The more data we accumulate, the more convincing it is that the impact of androgen deprivation in most patients with respect to survival is modest, particularly in the PSA progression scenario. So I think Anthony's made a major contribution with the observation that in the adjuvant setting, 6 months of therapy seems to be equivalent in most patients to longer duration of therapy. And to me, the thrust is in the opposite direction, that a little bit of hormonal therapy seems to be roughly equivalent to much more sustained and earlier therapy in the majority of patients.
Dan?
I think that what it makes the argument about 3 years versus 2 years versus 1 year, it throws it out the window because you're really not comparing these patients equivalently. You really need to look at their testosterone levels to see if they continue to be suppressed. Really, the only way to control these studies is to give 2 years of blockade and then give testosterone back to them to see if they actually have the same mortality.
I mean, is that really going to happen?
Well, there are some studies being designed in low-risk patients that are looking at that particular question to give testosterone supplementation after radical prostatectomy for those patients who are not but not those patients who have undergone androgen blockade.
Anthony, it's an interesting question of the clinical research implications of designing a study, in that you don't really know the duration of the treatment when you start out, unless you can maybe have a predictor of it.
Well, the way you would design such a study is exactly what Dr. Petrylak just said, and that is you would give everybody to start with the same amount of hormonal therapy in both arms. Let's just pick 6 months. And then you would follow their testosterone levels. And in one arm, you would not give any further hormonal therapy. And in the other arm, you would continue to give hormonal therapy to keep them below some threshold testosterone level for a prescribed period of time, perhaps 2 years. And then you would look to see if, in fact, in the arm that had the longer duration of testosterone suppression over that 2-year period, which was guaranteed, whether there was a difference or not.
Lori?
You know, one of the problems is you used recovery to baseline as the determinant, whereas, in fact, there's a lot of data that most men, after 6 or 8 months of androgen deprivation, recover at least to above 50%. Very few actually remain at castrate level. So one of the criticisms is, does it really matter whether they reach baseline? If they achieve 80 or 90% of baseline, they still have, from the perspective of a prostate cancer cell, a pretty substantial androgenic stimulus.
That's a very good point. So we looked at several different cut points and chose baseline for the one that we actually wrote. We looked at 200, which is still hypogonadal on the scale that we used. We looked at baseline, and we also looked at 100. And as you went to lower numbers, from baseline to 200 to 100, the effect remained, but the p-values increased because the power to see the difference was decreasing. The thing that's interesting, though, and I don't know that this is relevant to the cancer, but relevant to the individual, there are studies that show that the side effects that you experience, particularly the hot flushes, appear to stay until you get back close to or in excess of your baseline. So a guy who lives at 700 as opposed to someone who lives at 300 might still be experiencing hot flushes when his testosterone level is 400.
Mac?
Anthony suggested that the data that he presented supported intermittent hormonal therapy, and I'm having trouble with that conclusion based on the data. In the control arm, where people are taking shorter durations of hormone therapy, there's an opportunity for the patients to receive hormone therapy when they fail. That would be analogous to intermittent hormonal therapy, especially in the U.S., and yet their survival is still lower in some of those high-risk patients. So it very well may be that if we were able to identify a threshold that was low enough, that that wouldn't happen, but the data don't give us enough information to allow us to determine that you don't lose something when you stop hormone therapy and allow people to recover. So that's a problem.
Anthony, could you respond to that?
You're absolutely right, Max. The thing I was saying about intermittent was you would give the hormonal therapy up front, then you would give them back hormonal therapy if their testosterone rose above a certain prescribed level. You wouldn't wait until the PSA failed until you would give the hormonal therapy back. But you're absolutely right. The data that's presented is hypothesis-generating. It's an observation that perhaps hormonal therapy, it's not how much hormonal therapy give you, how long it lasts, that matters. But the only way to know that for certain, and I'm not saying that we should be giving everybody 6 months of hormonal therapy, but I put it in light of what we're learning about the toxicity of hormonal therapy, and perhaps there's a group of men in their 70s with pre-existing coronary disease, who should have an evaluation before they start, and then maybe they shouldn't get long-term hormonal therapy, even if they have a Gleason 8 T3 cancer. That's what I'm thinking. I'm not thinking of, you know, a younger or middle-aged person who's otherwise healthy.
The other point, the main criticism that I hear from practicing radiation oncologists is that if you cure the patient, so if you give the patient high enough doses of radiation that they don't have local persistence of disease, then the benefits of hormone therapy may be very different than some of these earlier studies. So, for example, in RTOG 8531, where 70 gray was given to people whose median PSA was around 30, patients had T2C to T3 disease, and the techniques that were used in those days were such that we know that not only were the tumors underdosed, but they were actually missed in some cases. So we know that what we're looking at here are patients who had persistent disease, whose persistent local disease is now being treated with hormone therapy. If those patients had been treated more aggressively and their prostates had been sterilized, you may not see the same impact of long-term hormone therapy. So I think that as we move toward what are the most important questions for using hormone therapy and radiation, one of them will have to relate to the issue of obtaining long-term local control and therefore focusing on patients who don't just have persistent local disease, but people who have systemic disease from the outset.
What would you say right now to a patient 65, 75 years old who no prior cardiovascular events about the absolute risk of taking hormonal therapy?
From that study, the absolute risk was 2% in men whose median age was 69 and men who were selected for radiation therapy for prostate cancer, which may mean they were not as healthy as someone who would be selected for surgery.
And do we know more? I would think not with such small number of patients, you know, whether exercise or diet could have modified that.
That's not been studied to my knowledge.
What would you speculate, Steve? Would you agree with a 2% kind of figure? And could you modify that by counseling your patient?
Yeah, I mean, I think the 2% is probably real. There's certainly pathophysiological reasons to believe that lowering testosterone levels would affect the heart. I mean, the heart is a muscle. Testosterone is an anabolic steroid. It builds up muscle. You take it away, you're going to lose muscle mass. We increase fat mass. Both fat and muscle mass are important in regulating blood sugar levels. So it's not surprising we see an increased risk of diabetes. And I think importantly, a lot of those can be prevented or reduced with proper diet and exercise. And actually, it's very interesting, there was an animal study where they actually took rats, normal rats, and they gave them LHRH agonist. And within several weeks, the rats developed cardiomyopathy. Whereas they had another group where they gave LHRH agonists to the rats, but exercised them, and their hearts looked completely normal.
I'm curious from the group in general, but starting with you, Steve, specifically, what do you see in men who go on androgen deprivation? Did they clinically tell you, well, I used to work out and I stopped? I mean, you see a difference in their lifestyle?
Absolutely. It's definitely harder for them to exercise. They gain weight. They feel more sluggish. And so for me, that is a very important part of putting any newly diagnosed cancer patient as an opportunity to intervene in terms of their diet, their lifestyle, but particularly those going on hormonal therapy, exercise, cutting out the sugars, cutting out the red meat.
Dave?
I think we have to put all this in a perspective. Years ago when we used hormonal therapy, it was an advanced disease, and people, many of them were bedridden, had pain, and had dramatic responses. And it had a tremendous place in the management of prostate cancer. And because of the advent of LHRH agonists and anti-androgens, the use of hormone therapy has drifted down to earlier stage disease, where they've shown adjuvant with radiation and neoadjuvant studies, and probably with radical prostatectomy that makes a difference in high-risk patients. What we've known for a long time, that men that are hypogonadal from the Massachusetts Male Aging Study and other studies, have an increased cardiovascular mortality. So this is not a real surprise. Mark Garnick brought this up years ago about the increased cardiovascular side effects of hormonal therapy. It was noted in his studies with Abiraterone, and it was noted with the bicalutamide studies. So every drug has a side effect.
Bicalutamide monotherapy?
Right.
But was that atherosclerotic myocardial infarction?
My understanding was, and the guys from Canada know this more than I do, that one of the reasons that it was altered in Canada or taken off the market was related to cardiovascular risk.
Was that myocardial infarction, Laurie, or QT interval?
It was not a specific identifiable increased cause of death. It was more global, but actually the single area that had the highest increase was unexplained death, which is thought possibly to be fatal arrhythmia related to prolongation of the QT interval.
So anyway, I think we have to put this all in perspective. Hormone therapy has a major place in the management of prostate cancer. Less may not always be beneficial. I know Anthony's done a lot of work with 6-month, but I think Bola challenged that again at ASCO this year, where he said 6-month doesn't work as well as the longer androgen deprivation. And we have level one evidence from that trial and some other trials that Mack and the RTOG have done that show that a definitive amount of hormone therapy is a benefit in survival. So, yeah, there's risk involved in it. We know that hypogonadism is associated with side effects. And, you know, people, they need to weigh the benefit versus the side effects.
Tom?
We also don't know a lot about the washout. I mean, there's a lot of different agents that we give that have different times for washout. That was shown 2 years ago, that you could still see remnants within the circulation, and that may account also for the differences in the recovery period. And different patients recover differently. I agree with what Anthony has said, and we've shown it in a series we presented this year at the Southeastern section, that if you're over 70 in our series, only 17% of men ever came close to a normal testosterone after 5 years of hormonal therapy. If you were under 70, 70% of the patients recovered.
Dan?
I think there are two points that are important. First, we need to know what population of patients were the ones who developed cardiovascular problems. Were these the ones who were already on cardiac medications? Did they already have chest pain? Did they already have some other precipitating factor that could lead us to selecting them? And then if they were not, does every patient need a cardiovascular examination or evaluation, including a stress test prior to going on androgen blockade? A second quick point related to the exercise. I can email you a great article that George Sheehan, the marathon runner, wrote about his experiences with intermittent hormone therapy and how he couldn't race when he was on hormones. Even though his blood tests were normal, he just simply couldn't run.
Interesting. Mike?
I think along the lines Dan had mentioned, and I know Anthony has brought this up in his publications, the question about screening these patients with cardiovascular evaluations beforehand. And if you're talking about the metabolic syndrome, correct me if I'm wrong, but many of these patients may not have obvious cardiovascular pathology up front. And the real question is whether a baseline stress test is really going to select these patients out for you. And this would have major economic implications for patients who are just routinely getting hormonal therapy.
Anthony?
Michael's point is extremely well taken. Even if you thought you could identify the high-risk group of people who are likely to be in that 2%, so a 70-year-old who's had a prior MI, who's a diabetic and a smoker, for example, let's say that was the person, there's no guarantee that, number one, the diagnostic test that needs to be done is going to ascertain everything that's important. So the diagnostic test needs to be identified, although a stress test is probably the leading candidate, or a PET CT of the heart if one had the resource. And the second thing is, within the world of cardiology, what I've learned from going to their meetings recently and talking to them is that when you have a 70% occlusion in a non-dominant vessel, there's an argument as to whether that's even clinically significant. It's not only what test you would order, it's then what do you need to discern in order to say that this is clinically significant and needs correction. I just think that there's an observation that there's something going on, and it would really behoove probably the cardiology / oncology community to study it further, both in terms of what test and then what to act on and how to act.
There's been at least three papers that have looked at global groups of patients on hormonal therapy that when you correct for comorbidities, pre-existing, the difference in the populations almost goes away. The other thing is about 3 or 4 years ago, I started checking testosterone levels when all the data came out about the prolonged suppression. And I think what the study suggests is maybe we need to go back and start paying more attention to testosterone levels of our patients at the time of initial diagnosis and in their follow-up period, which I think is what most doctors don't do at this point. And I think this all suggests maybe we need to pay a little bit more attention to testosterone and testosterone recovery in these patients after treatment with LHRH analogs.
William?
I've seen at least three studies that have shown that when you have a high risk of systemic disease, that hormonal therapy, not just hormonal therapy, but the longer duration of hormonal therapy is associated with significant clinically relevant outcome differences. And while I think we all agree that there's cardiovascular risk that we didn't appreciate before, you know, looking at these very high-risk patients and looking at a 2% death rate versus much more significant prostate cancer death rate over comparable periods of time, I think we have to put that into perspective.
There's no question that we're getting the flavor here that longer courses are translating into better clinical outcomes.
I think that the issue of what is high risk, I mean, you know, we throw these terms around high risk. And so what some people mean by that is their PSA is over 10 and they have a Gleason 7. Well, those patients are high risk for biochemical failure with conventional doses of radiation. There are other ways of looking at risk in which you can define risk as people who are at higher risk of dying of prostate cancer or having metastases. So I think that if we were more specific about the context...
So let me ask you, do you think that there's sort of subsets out there that are being undertreated?
No question.
Which ones?
The T3, Gleason 8s. I mean, I see patients who have high-grade tumors who will get a seed implant alone. Get no hormone therapy. They'll say, well, you don't need hormone therapy because those studies use external beam at lower doses, and they'll have a high-grade tumor associated with a high risk of distant failure, poor control weight with radical prostatectomy. Yeah. And those patients will be treated with monotherapy, just radiating their prostate. I see it all the time. I think that that's substandard.
Steve?
If you look at Anthony's data with the 6 months of hormone therapy versus no hormonal therapy, you get an increased risk of cardiac mortality that seems to be within that first few years, and then with time, up by 7 years, goes away. So I wonder if, and that was 6 months of hormonal therapy. The problem is we don't know what 3 years of hormonal therapy would do to the heart. But if we think about this as the initial course of hormonal therapy is your physiological stress test, so to speak, and that if you are going to have a fatal MI, you have it within those first few years, and if you've made it past your year or two on hormones and haven't had a fatal MI, then what would be the downside to continuing it on for 3 to 4 years? There's a lot of quality of life issues. And if that's true, then any hormonal therapy would be bad. My question would be to Mac is, if we are going to push the dose, your proposed study would be 2 years versus 4 months. How about if we're pushing the dose with a no hormone therapy arm, maybe for the intermediate risk patients like Anthony's JAMA paper, not the high risk BOLA, but the intermediate risk, high dose radiation with no hormones?
Which specific entry criteria?
I would say you would probably use intermediate risk as Anthony has defined it previously, your Gleason 7s, more the 4 plus 3, high T2B, PSA is above 10, certainly high velocity would put in there as well.
How do you usually approach those patients off study?
If they're going to have surgery, we do surgery alone and then see, based upon pathology, whether we need adjuvant treatment or salvage if they fail. In terms of radiation, usually it'd be a 6-month course of combined androgen blockade. But I'm wondering, if we push our dose with IMRT, do we need the hormones at all?
We actually had a trial at our institution of no hormones and high dose radiation versus hormones and lower doses of radiation. Maybe because of just a single institution randomized trial, we could not get patients on board this study because most of the outside referring physicians or the patients they'd seen in consultation were being, as a standard of care, were being pushed to get hormonal therapy. So it may not be an easy study. But a follow-up question that you were posing to Anthony, with the initial phase of myocardial infarctions maybe earlier on, is that anything related to maybe the lack of long-term follow-up yet in your study, that you don't have as many patients at risk at 10 years who have been evaluated, and still there could be a continued risk of cardiovascular deaths as well?
There certainly could be a continued risk out long-term. In fact, in the CAPSURE database, where the follow-up does go out a little bit longer, there seems to be two waves of myocardial death. One is up front, almost like an acute effect, and the other one seems to occur after 5 years, which may be the induction of metabolic syndrome, and then 5 to 7 years to actually see the impact of that induction on cardiovascular death. I just want to capitalize on something that Max said. I think it's in men undergoing radiation who are typically in their median ages of about 70, the addition of short course of hormonal therapy has prolonged survival. And the checking of a higher dose radiation in and of itself without hormonal therapy has prolonged progression-free survival. This makes complete sense. An impact on a local control modality would be expected at first to impact progression and then later perhaps distant and then overall survival. But it says that even short courses of hormonal therapy appear to impact micrometastatic disease, because you wouldn't get a survival benefit in the short course otherwise. And I do think that this relates to something about the biology of the patient that you're treating in addition to the cancer. And I think that since radiation patients tend to be older, that there really is some connection between the hormonal therapy that we give to them and how it affects them versus the hormonal therapy we gave to the surgical patients where it did no good at all with short courses of treatment. And I want to make one final point. I completely agree with what Michael and Mac and William said earlier, that there is evidence that longer terms of hormonal therapy are beneficial with regard to cancer-specific and overall survival. But the question is, in whom? We have to remember that the RTOG study and 9202 and this BOLA study really were looking at locally advanced disease. The problem I have is when you have a T1C, Gleason 8, PSA 6 patient who has, you know, 4 out of 12 cores with Gleason 8, this, and he's 59, this is the gentleman that I get most concerned about, because the data that we're talking about gets applied to him. And he either gets surgery followed by radiation and long-term hormonal therapy, or he gets radiation and long-term hormonal therapy. And I think that that's where we don't have any information, really, that describes well what we should do in that particular case.
What we saw in our patterns of care study, basically, it was a pretty dramatic split
in how people approach these based on whether they were a radiation oncologist or whether they were a urologist. Shouldn't be a big surprise, but the numbers are pretty dramatic. Dave, can you talk a little bit how you think through this kind of clinical situation? And it kind of relates back to what Steve was talking about in terms of these types of patients. So how would you be thinking this through, Dave?
I look at this with frustration because we've been trying to do clinical trials in localized prostate cancer to ascertain some data and answers for as long as I've been in the Southwest Oncology Group, which is 30 years. Years ago, Dr. Scardino, when he was a member of our group, had a randomized trial that we started of radiation versus surgery. We accrued a whopping 4 patients to that study in a year, and it was closed. You know, and since then, there have been lots of trials that got off the ground to look at issues like this of seed implantation versus surgery, of radiation versus surgery, of surgery versus nothing. And that's the VA trial that fortunately has been approved. And so we're going to have all these biases that exist.
Mike?
In a situation like this where a patient has at least, I guess we could call it intermediate risk disease, we recognize from the randomized trials that if he's going to choose radiation, he needs a high dose. And so I think some of that is certainly reflected there in terms of local therapies. If he's going to get a non-surgical approach, it's high-dose radiation or a combination approach. But I agree that, you know, when facing the patient right now in the absence of randomized trials, we're forced to say we don't have any evidence, one versus the other, and it's a matter of choosing some of their quality of life issues and some of their baseline urinary and rectal-related symptoms to try to help the patient navigate through. As far as hormonal therapy here, I think based on at least Anthony's study, it would be appropriate to add hormonal therapy. But I think, again, if the patient is getting ultra-high radiation doses and relatively low volume of disease, it's really unclear to me if it's been absolutely demonstrated for high radiation doses that you need hormonal therapy in this individual.
I love to hear these radiation oncologists. It's like Talmudic discussions. I had one doc in practice sent me an email, and he said, I mean, obviously, I don't know, you know, what I'm asking about half the time. He says, you know, there's all these things you should be asking these guys on your program about radiation oncology. I said, well, you know, send me some of the questions you like to see. He sent me 140 questions. Okay, Len?
There's a subtlety here, I think, that we see in our multidisciplinary center on a regular basis. And this is in all respect to the outstanding radiation oncology that's being done today. But radiation oncologists don't necessarily manage the complications of their treatment. Once a radiation-induced injury occurs, either in the urinary tract or in the rectum, they tend to be shipped off to somebody else, either the urologist or the colorectal surgeon. And it's been my experience that, and it's kind of consistent with what's said here, is that sometimes radiation oncologists, in all due respect, I'm deeply involved in, as everybody knows, working with them on trials, tend to underestimate the toxicity of some of their treatments because they're not burdened with the complication. If I unfortunately make somebody incontinent, I'm stuck with that guy and he comes to me. If they happen to get somebody with severe rectal bleeding, it's the colorectal surgeon that ends up. If I get the patient with hemorrhagic cystitis.
Need a blood pressure cuff, please.
You only know what you see.
Right.
So if they come, there are a lot of patients who don't have toxicity and they don't come to see you.
We understand that.
I have almost the same experience. I see a lot of patients that have radical prostatectomies who need salvage radiation or adjuvant radiation. So radiation oncologists frequently get the opinion, gee, so many radical prostatectomy patients are coming to see us all the time. Radical prostatectomy must not be such a great...
But, Mac, we send them to you.
I understand that. But what I'm saying
is that...
What I'm saying is that the patients who are cured by radical don't come see me. So what I'm saying is that when you, in your own practice, without understanding the numerator and the denominator... to make a statement that, oh, radiation oncologists, they don't know what their complications are. Well, they sent those patients to you, too. You're only seeing their complications. The patients who don't have complications, who are potent, don't have bleeding, they don't come to you. So you really don't have a numerator and a denominator.
When I work in a multidisciplinary center,
I understand.
We bring the patients back jointly.
We manage them together.
There's a significant difference in our own complications.
Laurie? Just a couple of points. I think, you know, we have pretty good data that the long-term toxicity between radiation and surgery is comparable in terms of its net effect on quality of life. So I don't really accept this argument that somehow the radiation oncologists are sweeping under the carpet or it's underestimated. You know, both groups are guilty of some of that in clinical practice. If you look to well-done prospective trials, the quality of life impact at a year, for example, is quite similar in my opinion. I'd just like to throw out another, sort of just to kind of push the envelope, if we're accepting that short-term androgen deprivation has a significant risk of fatal cardiac events, then to me that actually sways the equation in this kind of very borderline, this is a case that could go either way, and it's probably been designed just to evoke the maximum split in opinion.
Do you go, incidentally, when you're mind, when you see a patient, are you going with a number of around 2% in terms of serious complications, cardiovascular complications?
Well, the view I've had for many years has been that the effect of androgen deprivation is cumulative and that short-term androgen deprivation has relatively few systemic effects and does not put the patient very much at risk. So what I'm hearing is that that view may have to be altered to some degree. Remember that those patients who have an early MI have lost a lot. I mean, when we intervene radically with prostate cancer, we are adding to the patient's life 10, 15 years down the road. The patient who dies of an MI after 6 months of androgen deprivation therapy, that counts for a lot in the grand scheme of things in terms of the net benefit and harm. And I think perhaps that knowledge might alter the equation in a case like this, where if he has primary surgery, he's getting surgery alone, or perhaps surgery plus adjuvant RADS. If he's getting primary radiation, he's an intermediate risk patient, you've got to expose him to that risk of 6 months of androgen deprivation, and maybe that's a reason to kind of shift this kind of very admittedly borderline case more towards the surgery side.
Mary Ellen?
The discussion with the patient would be between prostatectomy and radiation and 6 months of hormones. And then I would feel that part of our role is to take a careful medical history, look at the patient physiologically in terms of weight and activity level, and, you know, really explore with them the possible risks and benefits of the hormones combined with the radiation if they chose that route. In my experience, it's nice that we can talk about telling the patients, oh, you need to diet, you need to exercise, but most of these patients are in an age group where if they haven't been exercising for the last 50 years, it's a hard practice to just start committing to and following through with.
To me, an interesting dichotomy that I just observed in prostate cancer for a few years is this thing about radiation therapy. In these kinds of situations, you get hormones, surgery, you don't. We were talking before about micrometastatic disease. You think of that model, the local therapy is not going to affect it. Right. Theoretically, would you expect that androgen deprivation in this situation would add something to the patient getting radical prostatectomy?
Yeah.
Theoretically, yes. Maybe we didn't look at long enough hormones. 3 to 6 months may have not been enough to show a benefit for a patient who has clear, established microscopic systemic disease to get a benefit with surgery.
Anthony?
I'm going to just be a little provocative, and I don't know the answer just yet, but I think that, you know, this patient, exactly what Mary Ellen said, is it surgery or is it radiation? But the point you just made is a good one. Perhaps, I said it before, but I'll highlight it again, perhaps the reason why all of the 5 randomized trials with surgery with 3 months of hormonal therapy did not show a benefit is because that these men, short course hormonal therapy was homeopathic. They did not suppress their testosterone for very long. I'm not convinced that adding hormones to surgery may not produce a benefit. It may very well. And what do we do when we see this man? So when I see him, it's the discussion of radiation hormones versus surgery. But if he goes to surgery and he's upgraded to an 8 or he has seminal vesicle invasion, then the whole concept comes out, well, post-op radiation and then what about a short course of hormonal therapy? So what this guy ends up getting when I discuss it with him is it's surgery, radiation hormones to start, but then it's surgery with the possible need of post-op radiation and hormones to follow. The duration really, I think, in my mind, depends upon how virile he is, how long his testosterone stays suppressed with a given amount of hormonal therapy. And while that's investigational, that's how I currently look at this. So I do think that for this gentleman, and make it even a little better, make him 59 and make it a Gleason 8 and keep everything else the same. And then it gets even harder because now you've got a young guy who you want to operate on because that's the best chance to cure him, as the people sort of say. And yet he's got a Gleason 8 and you're not going to give him hormonal therapy. Yet we know hormonal therapy is prolonging survival in older men who get radiation. So there is an issue here.
Laurie?
I just want to invoke the ERTC 30891, the Studer trial, that was early versus delayed hormonal therapy in patients who got no other primary therapy, that showed no difference in prostate cancer survival at all.
But a benefit in overall survival.
Yeah. A benefit in overall survival due to, paradoxically, increase in non-prostate cancer mortality in the delayed therapy arm. In other words, there seemed to be a survival benefit to early hormonal therapy unrelated to prostate cancer mortality, which is kind of hard to explain. But the point is, where is the benefit on the micrometastases outside of the synergistic effect with radiation? Where is the benefit on micrometastasis in that study, if it really exists? I don't know how to integrate the results of BOLA with that large, well-done study.
Has that been adequately addressed? We have data with enough events to address the question?
The way you address it, Laurie, is as possible, is if you talk to Erst himself, he'll tell you that the ascertainment of the cause of death in these studies is not ideal. And so he is reluctant to put up prostate cancer-specific survival as an endpoint because, you know, how it was coded is not clear. So I really look at the overall survival, and if you look at that, then it is consistent with all of the other studies.
Dan?
I think one of the other things that we also have to keep in mind is the fact that androgen blockade will induce hypoxia. And this actually, you know, you'll cause increased levels of VEGF, you'll cause degradation of some of the vasculature.
Hypoxia in the tumor.
Within the tumor. So the question is, how does that interact with radiation therapy? And you may get more effect that way. There may be a synergistic effect that way.
Well,
so
although hypoxia is it doesn't induce an environment for radiosensitization.
Right. So there may be some other issues about the interactions between.
That's interesting, though. So would you speculate that an anti-angiogenic approach, and bevacizumab is being used in a lot of tumors are being studied in prostate cancer, would that make sense to put it together?
It makes sense to put it together, absolutely.
Interesting. Tom?
One of the things about this case is that has not been mentioned. In my area, a lot of people who have this kind of tumor would be offered high-dose radiation therapy with no hormones as a upfront and single treatment. I mean, that happens all the time where I live, and you know it happens in your area too. And where everybody around this table has accepted the fact that if you're going to use radiation, we should be considering hormones in this as an intermediate risk case based on Anthony's data. Second point is, you're right, Anthony. I mean, he may be at least an 8, and the only way you're going to find that out is if you take the prostate out and you look at it pathologically, and we know exactly what we're dealing with, because you're going to undertreat the guy if you don't. And finally, as regards your statement about the neoadjuvant, Laurie's colleagues did, and Laurie himself did, an 8-month study of neoadjuvant hormonal therapy, and it didn't work there either. And I know there were some nuances to that trial that weren't made public, but do you agree with what Anthony has said?
Well, it was eight months. Eight versus three, right?
It was 8 versus 3, just 2 points. In an earlier Canadian study of 3 months, in the high-risk subset, this is retrospective stratification analysis, there was a benefit to the neoadjuvant therapy in the patients with a PSA over 20, which supports your... And none of those neoadjuvant studies were enriched for high-risk patients. So I completely agree with that point that we really don't know the answer in the high-risk patients. In the 3 versus 8 study, neoadjuvant, there was actually a benefit in the centers that had a high volume of radical prostatectomies. In the low-volume centers, there was no benefit. So what it suggests is maybe neoadjuvant therapy prior to surgery has to be done in the context of a surgeon who is kind of familiar with doing the operation in patients who've been cytoreduced with hormones.
Dave?
I have to comment on these neoadjuvant trials with surgery. There have been a number of them done. They've varied the hormones for 3 months, 4 months, 8 months. And they all show some histologic benefit and some effect. But what they don't show is a difference in PSA recurrence and survival rate. What we have to remember is these are long-term studies in prostate cancer, even in our adjuvant radiation trial, which the radiation guys love to talk about, the big benefit. There's no survival benefit, yet we accept radiation, and I believe it, as an adjuvant in high-risk prostate cancer. These trials are 15-year trials. My bet is that the Soloway trial, the DeBrine trial, the Canadian trial, when we look at it at 15 years, are going to show a survival benefit, much like the Messing trial when it was first looked at 5 years, and I'll talk about that, and you're going to talk about that, the adjuvant hormone therapy in prostate showed a benefit. So these are long-term trials. Dr. Klotz's comment about high and low volume centers, I think, is very weak. If you do a subset analysis and a subset analysis and a subset analysis, he probably could have looked at surgeons who had more hair versus less hair, and it may have been a positive thing. So to say that in a, you know,
negative,
a small
actually,
study,
yeah.
To say that in a small study, I think is very misleading.
It was 540 patients.
It's a small study.
But I want to take your bet, Dave, because you're wrong. The fact is, it's not going to show a difference with long-term follow-up because there was no difference in PSA failure. I mean, you got to have some evidence that there's some other than the pathology. The PSA failure rate is unchanged. The patient population, their risk of dying of prostate cancer is too low, and the sample sizes of studies are small. And the bottom line is 15 years from now, there's still going to be negative studies. The fact is that, as Lori alluded to, hormones and radiation, there's a biologic interaction occurring, which is not happening with surgery.
Because it makes the radiation work. I mean, I remember years ago that the radiation oncologist said, you never use hormones with radiation because radiation works on actively dividing cells. And then all of a sudden,
that's when
the hormones make
man,
radiation
Dave.
Look good, and everybody's all excited about it. Come on, give me a break.
I'm going to ask back to Mike about this issue of high-dose radiation without hormone therapy in this kind of patient, but also to mention to you that the most frequent comment we get from people who use our programs is they like it when people don't know the right answer, because they're sitting out there.
They're going to love
thinking
this.
That, you know, it's them, and they can't figure it out. When they hear you struggle and you argue, that's very reassuring to docs in practice that they're in the right place. Mike, what about this issue of high-dose therapy without hormones?
Well, I convey to the patients regarding intermediate risk disease and the available trial from Anthony about 6 months of hormonal therapy and that survival benefit. But again, it's with 70 gray of radiation. And all bets are off when you're going to higher doses. But if you look at the randomized dose escalation trials, you don't see that kind of decrement in survival benefit like Anthony had seen. It's a surprising finding that those patients were dying off more than what we're seeing in some of the dose escalation trials. And so I'm not yet convinced that with high dose radiation, we are doing a patient a disservice, perhaps a favor in terms of avoiding the hormonal therapy if we're giving them 78 or 81 gray.
But in terms of practical decision making, do you recommend that? Do you offer it as an option? How do you discuss
it? Well, for patients with low volume disease, Gleason 7, if there's a high amount of 4 component in there, I'm going to be a little bit concerned. But otherwise, we are offering such patients high-dose radiation alone, especially if sexual function and other issues are important for the patient.
Mac?
I really have to make 3 points. First, there was this mention that these patients who've been for 50 years not eating right, not doing these things right, that if you talk to them about changing their diet and lifestyle, that they're not going to respond to it. I disagree. When men are diagnosed as having prostate cancer, maybe it's just in California, the majority of them start taking lycopene, soy, saw palmetto, they lose weight,
juice.
They start doing all this stuff. That is an opportunity for people to make recommendations about addition. I tell my patients, I'm going to be very upset with you if you die of something else. Okay, so you need to, like, get your cholesterol and your blood pressure under control.
They're going to have to die then.
Where everybody dies, but I want them to take care of, I don't want them to have a heart attack after I treated them because of hormone therapy. So I do warn them about it. So I think men will do a lifestyle change. That's number one. Number two, I think it's important that people understand that the prognosis of this patient is actually not very good. Based on long-term follow-up, 1,600 patients, radical prostatectomy for Gleason 7's Mayo Clinic, the majority of the patients fail. With the Gleason 4 plus 3, the 10-year control rate is 38%. So these patients don't do well. They need aggressive treatment. And number three, we're throwing around the term short-term hormone therapy, and sometimes we say 3 months, sometimes we say 6 months. I think we need to figure out whether they are really different. I think that the study done down under is a study that hasn't convinced me that 6 months is better than 3 months. So I think that it may be that men don't need 6 months of hormone therapy, but they need hormone therapy because the biologic interaction between hormone therapy and radiation for the intermediate risk patient may not require 6 months to be beneficial.
So before Steve and Dan comment, the same patient who's seen Mike decides to fly out to you to get a second opinion says, Dr. Zaleski said, he would offer me high-dose radiation therapy without hormones. What do you think?
I wouldn't do that. I would at least advise him. I recommend you take hormones and radiation. I recommend treating the pelvic lymph nodes in this patient. And pelvic lymph node radiation requires hormone therapy for it to be effective. So I would give neoadjuvant hormone therapy, treat the pelvic lymph nodes, and then implant the prostate is my standard approach to this kind of patient.
Steve?
I want to echo what Max said about the diet and exercise. I think these patients are very receptive, and a lot of it is, I think, how much time you spend counseling them. But for me, it's not only counseling them about the cardiovascular effects of their diet and exercise, but I put it in the context of their cancer, because obviously that's what brought them into me, and said, look, there's a two-thirds chance this patient is overweight or obese, and we have objective data that I can't do as good of a cancer surgery. I'm more likely to leave a positive margin in an obese man, and that's data from many centers. So I say to the patient, if he can lose weight, we can do a better surgery. In terms of radiation, most of the people here are saying you're going to go on hormonal therapy. It's going to affect your insulin sensitivity. We need to get you on a good diet. And then finally, the other thing is something very interesting, an idea actually working with Mark Dewhurst, who's a PhD DVM radiation oncologist at Duke. We're actually coming up and thinking about how does radiation work with the, and it's been talked about a little bit, that it kills normoxic cells. It cannot kill the hypoxic cells well. But hypoxic cells means they have very poor access to the blood supply. So if we can lower their calories and make the little bit of blood that these cells are seeing even more hostile, give them less nutrients, we think with the dietary approach, we can help kill selectively the hypoxic cells. Radiation can kill the normoxic. And we're doing that in an animal model, combining diet plus radiation to improve cancer control.
What about the issue of diet and exercise and the disease and disease progression?
We have some pretty good animal data that says if you go on caloric restriction has really been the big thing shown most profoundly. So losing weight will slow tumor growth in animals. Low-fat diet has also been looked at.
And we have been looked at in Capture or any other?
In terms of the health professionals looked at it with Ed Giovannucci, June Chan up in Boston and showed men that ate a lot of fish and tomatoes reduced the risk of relapse. So we have some circumstantial human data, but in terms of preventing progression, very limited. In terms of preventing the disease, weight loss has been shown to reduce risk of prostate cancer.
Final comment from Dan.
I agree with what Dave said about the long-term follow-up on these adjuvant studies or the neoadjuvant studies. Think of it this way. You've got an androgen-regulated gene. You've seen from the earlier presentations that the response or the recovery to hormone therapy is inconsistent. So I think the PSA relapse may not be the right measure to look at in these patients because you're not going to get a consistent expression of PSA based upon their testosterone levels. So I think you need the long-term follow-up in these patients really to see what's going to happen.
William?
My question to Anthony was, what is the impact of concurrent radiation and hormonal therapy on testicular recovery? And is there any data to suggest whether the recovery rates would be different in a patient who just gets 6 months of hormonal therapy alone?
So you were talking about the question of whether radiation therapy itself affected testicular function as it's given in this situation. Anthony, what's the answer?
What we know is the Leydig cells are what produce testosterone, and their tolerance is about 40 to 45 gray, which is much, much higher than what you would get from a scattered dose of radiation with today's techniques. It's clear that, 15 years ago when people would treat huge fields and not have any definition of the prostate, that the dose to the testicles could have been significant, but that shouldn't be the case today. What the dialogue was back and forth is, it would be interesting to see if there was any impact of radiation dose on testosterone rebound after you adjust for a patient's age and baseline testosterone level to see if, in fact, as dose goes up, whether that scatter dose to the testicle means anything. I don't think it will, because the scatter dose is about 1% of the primary beam, and 1% of 70, 80, or 90 gray is still less than, a gray.
There have been some publications on, and granted this was with radiation done years ago, of subtle decreases in testosterone after radiation therapy. They're not the castrate ranges, but the drop is 10 to 20%. Now, is that enough to have an effect? I don't know. If they're used to 300 and you drop it down to 260, is that going to have an effect on cancer? I don't know.
Mac?
There's actually some data. In RTOG 94-13, we did a study where we gave hormone therapy before radiation and during.
versus giving hormone therapy after radiation. And there was a difference in the recovery of testosterone, but I don't remember. I think it took longer for it to recover in the patients who received hormone therapy after radiation. It was presented as an abstract at a meeting, and I haven't seen the final publication. There are other examples where, for example, in kidney, if you radiate the kidney and then you expose it to platinum at a later date, you can get a delayed toxicity to the kidney. So there are biologic interactions that can be sequence dependent. And so there could be some differences related to the sequence of hormone therapy and radiation and testicular recovery.
The discussion then turned to the use of systemic therapy as an adjuvant after surgery and new trials evaluating adjuvant chemotherapy, including a SWOG study evaluating mitoxantrone and prednisone that was recently closed. Dr. Laurie Klotz began by discussing the massive EPC trial evaluating bicalutamide monotherapy in the adjuvant setting.
You would think that a study involving 8,000 people is an extraordinary opportunity to learn a great deal. And unfortunately, we haven't learned very much from that study. And it probably, in part at least, relates to flaws in the study design. So the study did not in any way select for higher risk patients. There were three sub-studies. Each one had somewhat different interventions, durations of therapy. Obviously, any treatment, surgery, radiation. So it was an attempt to do, I guess, a large, simple study. But I think that certainly if there had been some attempt, particularly to select for patients who are at higher risk for progression, the likelihood of learning something important would have been much greater.
What were the entry criteria in the SWOG study, and would that explain why you're not seeing enough events?
It was Gleason score 8 or better. It was positive margin seminal vesicle invasion, microscopic lymph node disease. It wasn't a nomogram. When we designed the study, it was in an area where we thought these people were at risk. And I think that the comment on Dr. Klotz's and the EPC study, again, just wait 10, 15 years. I bet you're going to see something emerge.
Len?
I think we fail to give ourselves credit in the field of prostate cancer for the challenges that we face that have been repeatedly alluded to by everyone in this room, that any intervention we take in prostate cancer may often take many years for the final outcome to be seen. You've seen that some of these trials have to go, RTO, famous now quoted RTOG trials, had to go 5, 8, 7 years before the survival curves really separated. And I think when you use the EPC trial as a fantastic example of how far we came in the last 10 years, because had the EPC trial been designed in the late 1990s after risk stratification came in, I believe it would have been a very powerful study, because it was only the subset analysis that really showed advantage in certain subsets of patients. So if we were smart enough in 93, 94, when that trial was designed, to pull out those high-risk patients, it may be a totally different study than we're looking at today.
Tom?
And the fact is, there's still over approaching 2,500 on the U.S. arm of that study, which admittedly there were low, intermediate, and high-risk patients there, and they were only treated for 2 years. The only value of that study is going to be on PSA progression, because the original study, they had to have objective progression, meaning bone scanning changes or CT scan change. So all we're going to learn from the state study is what happens to PSA, because everybody who was on that study who progressed immediately went off and got something else. Now, the European and the Scandinavian arms of that study may give us more information regarding the high-risk patients, but the American one's typically only going to be PSA progression.
How much of that is just the fact that, you know, it's a difficult disease with a long natural history and all these problems, and how much of it is you just can't get people in study?
There's a couple things. Number one, I think you hit an essence of the problem that we face professionally and in the media with prostate cancer, is that people want the answer immediately. If you compare breast cancer and prostate cancer, the average age of death of a man with prostate cancer compared to a woman tends to die 10 years younger than a man does from metastatic disease. Am I correct in that mm-hmm. statement? The process of breast cancer progressing and metastasizing is a much more rapid process than it is with prostate cancer. It tends to metastasize earlier and more aggressively. Another problem we face in prostate cancer that we don't have in breast cancer is, to the best of my knowledge, there is no consistent multifocality. It's been reported, but you don't see the same multifocality and the same autopsy incidence of prostate cancer that you have in breast cancer. So we have that confounder. We have the Wayne County autopsy series from Gay Poss and Wild Soccer that shows that men in their 20s and 30s are developing clinically foci of premalignant or premalignant changes of prostate cancer.
Microfoci.
Microfoci, but they're developing prostate cancer in their second and third decade of life that I don't believe you see in cases of breast cancer.
Although we did have positive randomized trials in chemotherapy and breast cancer in 1979. Dan?
So I think that it'd be important to take the 99-21 data and also the Thompson data with the adjuvant radiation therapy and take a look at the prognostic models, because we used those other characterizations, and see if that truly is a high-risk group of patients. You know, I thought it was kind of concerning that the event rate in Ian's study with the adjuvant radiation therapy was also very, very low. And in fact, if I remember correctly, precluded seeing a survival difference between the two because the event rate was a lot slower than was originally predicted. So, you know, is the disease changing?
We're also, I'm curious, okay, you look at deaths from prostate cancer this year. How many of these men started out as localized high-risk disease?
Not
many. How many of them started out as metastatic at diagnosis? Do we know sort of the demographics of that, Anthony?
Yeah, much more of them have started out as more advanced, the ones who are actually dying today. But we have a shift in the paradigm towards less advanced at presentation now. I just wanted to make a point to follow up on what Dan said. We have to remember that all three adjuvant radiation studies are looking at additional local therapy on top of local therapy. And so if that group was a lower risk group, then you might actually expect to see a benefit eventually in terms of local control translating to survival. But if it was more of a high-risk group, you wouldn't. I think it's very hard. The post-mastectomy radiation adjuvant studies are negative. They didn't become positive until they added tamoxifen to post-mastectomy radiation. And they became more positive when they added chemotherapy to post-mastectomy radiation. There is no study in breast cancer that shows that additional radiation after surgery has a survival benefit. It's as a meta-analysis, but there are no randomized trials. One point about EPC, we did learn something important from it. In the Scandinavian subset, the watchful waiting guys who got randomized to Casodex versus now versus later, in that group of men who were unhealthy or deemed not fit to undergo local therapy, the use of immediate Casodex led to a decrement in overall survival in that group. Not explained as to exactly what it was, but it points back to what we were discussing earlier, that it could have been in these men who are unhealthy, not fit to undergo local therapy, i.e. unhealthy, meaning probably have underlying cardiovascular risk, that the decrement in overall survival may have been induced by the earlier administration of hormonal therapy.
Lynn?
In follow-up to what Anthony said, we are sitting right now on what I would hope to be a breakthrough of things that we're alluding to here in the 9601 trial, which has been closed for about 4 years now, which is looking at exactly this issue of radical prostatectomy, high-risk pathologic T3 disease, randomized to Casodex 150 plus radiation versus radiation plus placebo. That trial's been closed for 4 or 5 years right now. You know, obviously nothing's happened yet from an event standpoint, but we are sitting on the verge, hopefully, of an answer to that similar breast cancer story that you alluded to.
Right. Steve, it's important.
I think one of the challenges in doing trials in the setting that hasn't been brought up is the pluses and minuses of PSA. And if you take the analogy to breast cancer, you do surgery, you do radiation, the next event will be metastasis. Whereas in prostate cancer, after surgery or radiation, the next event is a PSA relapse, which we know from the Pound series, at least in surgical patients, predates metastasis by 8 years. So I think for a lot of clinicians, urologists out there doing radical prostatectomy, and I'm one of them, I'm not anxious to do an adjuvant thing when I can wait for that PSA relapse, know that this guy truly is now at risk rather than a 50%, 60% chance. He's a 100% chance of relapse. Use that doubling time and really start to risk stratify better. So I think it certainly gives us a unique window of opportunity to detect these cancers earlier, but I think it does make doing trials in the setting more difficult.
Makes it more difficult. It also doesn't mean that starting therapy might not be better. We don't know. What about this issue of events in the SWOG study, Dave? Do we have data yet? Did the predictors sort of play out the way you thought they were going to play out?
No.
No.
I mean, that's why they closed the study, is that there weren't any of, I mean, there were some events, but I mean, they were very low. 1%, 2%?
Getting back to this question of we're focusing on decreasing prostate cancer mortality as sort of one important endpoint, again, do we know right now how many people who die of prostate cancer are presenting with metastatic disease as opposed to the kind of scenario you just described? Where are the deaths coming from? William?
I don't think there's any good data about that, partly because the entire presentation is shifting. But we do know that it's only a 1% or 2% of the population who present with prostate cancer have metastatic disease at presentation. The numbers in SEER registry have continued to go down. It's a very small number that present with de novo metastatic disease. So I actually think that of the people who are dying, a substantial proportion are still dying with locally advanced disease, still not visible on CT or bone scan, but progress rapidly to that point. And getting to this issue really of why events aren't occurring, I think if you look at the SWOG data, really there were two arms in which people got some therapy. And I think it's absolutely possible, because it's an unanswered question, that hormonal therapy in the control arm is diminishing the number of events. And it gets back to the bigger issue of what should the control arms be. And you're seeing this, I think, in the new trials, which are designing arms without any therapy whatsoever. And ironically, even though that's the right thing to do, you're seeing some impact, for example, in the TAX-3501 adjuvant study in accrual, which in some ways is really paradoxical. I think people, again, and prostate cancer investigators have shown this before, have made conclusions already about the value of hormonal therapy. Whether we believe EPC or any of these other trials or not, we still do not really understand what the impact of androgen deprivation is given immediately or adjuvantly. And yet, people are unwilling to randomize their two large studies where a control arm is no therapy whatsoever. And I think it's a real mistake, because I think we all agree hormonal therapy is important, but we just don't know what the relative impact is of starting it immediately.
Dan?
I think one other thing that we're missing in designing these studies is the issue of sequence. There was some data that was presented a couple of years ago showing that if you gave hormone therapy and chemotherapy concomitantly in women with breast cancer in the adjuvant setting, that the effect wasn't as great. And there's some good data out of Maryland that Arif Hussain has published showing that if you sequence chemotherapy first, then give the hormone therapy after that, that's your best way of administering treatment. None of these trials have incorporated that concept into this. And I think we may be losing some efficacy, or at least losing an answer to a very, very important question.
Mary Ellen.
We've been discussing this in our group for about 2 years and feel like it's an important area to investigate. And why we haven't is we haven't been able to get funding to do the trial we wanted to do.
Which is what?
Looking at chemotherapy alone, Taxotere alone, followed by CAB, versus starting them together. Very simple concept, but you need a fair number of patients. If the difference may be small, you need a fair number of patients to do it right.